Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But I'm going to ask that you hold your calls until we ask for them this evening, because we have with us a very special guest, not an infrequent guest on our program, Joel Skousen, the editor of World Affairs Brief, and I want him to get his information out before we take any calls. So without further ado, Joel, how are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you each week.
Well, it's always a pleasure having you here. Well, what are the latest things that you have come up with on the World Affairs Brief?
Well, the two major subjects, last week's brief was on the 9/11 Commission, and that's continuing this week with the rather predictable testimony of Condoleezza Rice, and then there's the flare-up of insurgency in Iraq, and it looks like it's a permanent change that's taking place in Iraq and deserving of our discussion tonight.
All right, well, just go right ahead.
Well, let's pick up with the 9/11 Commission. Just last week, I discussed what the 9/11 Commission really should be investigating. What we have in the testimony or the controversy around the testimony of National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice is a major diversion from the real issues that should be investigated. In other words, we make a big public controversy about whether or not the President is going to cede executive privilege and allow Condoleezza Rice to condescend and give her presence to the Commission, as well as other White House officials. Jim Ray was reported that the White House actually ended up making a secret deal with the Commission that in exchange for public televised testimony of Condoleezza Rice, that would guarantee that no other person from the White House would be required to testify. And so obviously, the President wouldn't be making that deal if they weren't trying to hide certain truths and keep embarrassing things away from the American people. I think the Commission members are in collusion with the White House proposal. That's why it was so easy to make this deal.
It was so interesting. Just comment, when it was Lee Hamilton was the first person to question Condoleezza Rice, and I noticed that he was looking down and reading scripted question before him. And after he had asked the scripted question, which was very pointed, why Condoleezza Rice looked down and read her scripted answer. Then he asked another scripted question. She gave another scripted answer, and I'm sitting there. I'm saying, they can't even look up and ask a question. It's all been scripted ahead of time. Now, it wasn't that way with all the people on the commission,
That
certainly was true with Lee Hamilton's questions. And you have to watch. The president often does that. When he is going to call upon a reporter, he looks down to find out who he's supposed to call. The reporter jumps up. He has a scripted question. The president looks down. He has a scripted answer. And it's all, it's all previously laid out ahead of time.
Yes, we call that a rigged system, politically,
right.
And it certainly is rigged. But it's interesting that in the overall picture, it doesn't matter what high-level government official that you bring before the commission. This is not where the real question should be going. The real question should be going to the specific people involved in providing key information that's surrounding the controversies of 9/11. For example, the identities of the hijackers. The U.S. has never revised their list of alleged hijackers, and we still really don't know who they are, and the administration doesn't know, though they claim this still the same list of 19 is valid, even though we know that either 7 or 8 are still alive, and that 9 of the 19 were either missing or dead even before 9/11 came about. The administration, knowing of the Internet, the real investigation of 9/11 is occurring on the Internet. In other words, that's where the independent investigators are publishing their results. And unfortunately, we reach certain roadblocks because sometimes you can't penetrate past the administration roadblocks that they're putting up. The administration, for example, could know or could clarify the official version easily if it's true. Now, that's the key point. If it's true, it could be easily verified. For example, a couple of cases in point. If these hijackers, who they claim hijacked the airplanes, do correspond with the list of 19 that they have, then they should be able to show us the surveillance video cameras of the passengers getting on the airplane. We should be able to see and have a little television arrow pointing to the people and getting a close-up of their photo and confirming that these are the people. The fact that they refuse to let us see these surveillance videos indicates that either no such hijackers exist, or they are different people than what they are saying they are. Now, it's also very suspicious that all of the Arabic names have been deleted from the published list, manifest list of passengers on all of the hijacked airplanes. Why are they doing that? I personally contacted the airlines to find out why these were edited, and they said they were edited, that they handed over the entire list, and the government edited it. For example, there's a great deal of controversy about the crash of Flight 77 into the Pentagon. And, you have a hole 18 feet wide, which couldn't possibly account for the kind of destruction that penetrated three rings of the Pentagon. You have a leaked and doctored, in my opinion, a set of videos from the Pentagon surveillance cameras. Now, these had to be leaked from a government source. They are not the complete video. What's interesting about the video excerpts is that it does not show a Boeing 757 airliner crashing into the Pentagon. If anything is visible at all, it's a small jet about the size of an A-4 Skyhawk or an F-16. And there is a quirky little white puff. It's not a puff, it's a series of rolling puffs beneath this little glimpse of an airplane, giving the impression, if you look at it closely, that a missile was fired. Now, the biggest evidence that something like a missile was fired at the Pentagon is the fact that the video clearly shows a huge, white, high-explosive initiation of the explosion, and then a fireball after that. Now, you cannot get that, I repeat, as a person in the military who's fired missiles and seen crashes and seen these types of things happen, you cannot get any white, bright white explosion from an airliner hitting any object. It simply is a big red-black fuel fireball from the very inception, just like what happened in the crash of the airliner into the World Trade Center. You didn't see any white flash, It was simply a big red and black boiling oil fire. Now, you get a huge white, high explosive illumination from the beginning of that. That shows that something struck the Pentagon at the moment of impact that was a high explosive. And that would account for penetrating three reinforced concrete rings of the Pentagon and coming out with a 12-foot hole on the C-ring. People have facetiously said, well, it was the core of the engine that went through that. Well, no, it isn't. This is a turbofan engine, approximately 10 feet in diameter, filled with lots of blades and other things. Even the core shaft couldn't have gone through that because when it hits the building at an angle, that huge, great, big assembly is going to hit at different rates and densities, and it's going to tumble. There's no way that that shaft is going to penetrate in a straight line for three things because of the angle of which it hit. Those are some of the problems that we see, you know, with the Pentagon. And yet, the government confiscated the gas station video, surveillance video camera, within, the attendant said, within about 5 minutes of the crash on the Pentagon. They had FBI agents showing up at this gas station requiring that they turn over their surveillance video. Now, how did they know to be there so quickly?
I would have thought that if it had been a large airliner, it would have sheared the wings off.
Certainly in an 18-foot hole it would have, and there's no debris except for one perhaps planted piece of evidence on the outside lawn. It's very, very strange. Now, if it, some have hypothesized that the actual airliner, which some witnesses did see, simply overflew the Pentagon and landed at Reagan International or otherwise, and we don't know what happened to it. Others did actually see, and there are at least two witnesses said they saw a much smaller jet. Even the knockdown poles don't correspond with the flight path of what the witnesses said the larger airline took. So there may indeed have been two aircraft involved in the attack on the Pentagon. And certainly if there were a missile fired at it from one of the aircrafts to pave the way or to punch through, and then followed by this small aircraft, which probably, you know, could be a remote-controlled aircraft, that certainly would account for the damage in the Pentagon, plus the explosion and the penetration of all three rings. But what I'm saying is the government could easily dispel all of these rumors about the airliner not crashing the restaurant by Pentagon by simply delivering up the video and delivering up the parking lot video so that we could see the actual aircraft, and it's edited out of there. Now, why do I think that the Pentagon video is edited? And I do think it is edited because as a pilot who has fired missiles from a fighter aircraft, I can tell you that it doesn't make a smoke trail that looks anything like the one that's on that video. Nothing flying at that kind of speed makes a little puffy cloud-type smoke trail. It's a very jetting, fast, exiting smoke trail that is just a stream of white, not puffy white clouds. It does appear that it was doctored. Why would it have been doctored? I think maybe there was an insider within the Pentagon that had access to the video. It probably did not show the missile clearly. He knew that a missile was involved in the attack, so he doctored in the puffs on it so that someone would more easily come to the conclusion that a missile was fired. That's what I think happened. It was a whistleblower within the Pentagon. Remember, this was an anonymous leak from someone within the Pentagon to the news media, and the date was changed, and that's another indication. The date does not match the actual attack. That's another indication that it was doctored. It was changed in some way graphically. So now you can see, Stan, these are very interesting questions. You know, you can write them off as conspiracy theories, to be sure, but certainly they make excellent investigative material, and the 9/11 Commission isn't touching these very crucial issues.
Yes, well, all of these things are very concerning to me, because I think the purpose of the 9/11 Commission is not to reveal but to conceal what really happened, but by emphasizing all the other things, we don't never get down to the exact issues, and there's so much information overload that people can't see the forest for the trees.
Now, that's one of the interesting things, precisely what you're saying about this diversion of people's attention. I think they've made this controversy, they've conjured up this White House high-level testimony, you know, and they throw softball questions at them. You know, what could the United States have done better to prepare for 9/11? You know, you can give any answer from A to Z from that, and what are you going to say? I listened to the testimony of General Counsel Richard Benvenista interviewing or questioning Richard Armitage. I listened to the questioning of CIA Director Tenet. And it was very, very obvious that there was a camaraderie between these people. They were joking and saying nice things and complimenting one another before they got into it. And Benvenista only asked softball questions to them. And when he did ask what appeared to be a tough question, you know that it really wasn't a tough question because there was no follow-up. When he gave the predictable, easy answer that didn't really answer the question, Benvenista refused to follow up. Now, an experienced trial lawyer used to Crockett's examination would certainly know how to set a trap, how to ask a leading question or a question that may disarm the witness and get them to answer something to which they have already in his back pocket contradictory evidence that he can trap them in questions 3, 4, or 5. We saw none of that with Condoleezza Rice. In fact, we had not only softball questions, we had what one journalist referred to as T-ball questions. Such an easy question. They answered questions like it was handing her an opportunity to sit there and eulogize and defend the president and the administration. I have to say this about Condoleezza Rice. She is the most abject, yes-man, loyalist to the president I have ever seen in government. You know, she has absolutely no credibility with thinking people when she refuses to acknowledge in the least any criticism of the president. She will virtually deny any wrongdoing, any mistake, any artful thought from the president. She will deny that there's anything wrong. I mean, I have never seen the likes of an intelligent person not at least saying to a journalist who asked a tough question, yes, I agree the administration or the president may not have thought this out well, but in his defense, here's such and such as that. But she won't even do that. In fact, what was interesting in her testimony, she departed from the mission of the 9/11 Commission and took significant time to sit there and justify President Bush's going to war in Iraq. What was notable about that was that she did not attempt to say it was over weapons of mass destruction. She did not mention that as one of the two major reasons. She said Bush went to war in Iraq because, number one, it was violating the no-fly zone, and number two, that Saddam Hussein tried to assassinate the president. Now, these are both hollow on the facts. In the first place, even though the United Nations passed a resolution about containment of Iraq and the no-fly zone, this no-fly zone was determined by the U.S. and put through the United Nations, and there were no enforcement provisions. The U.S. unilaterally decided to enforce it. And so here you have the United States not only unilaterally enforcing a no-fly zone, which was a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. They actually used that excuse of enforcement to soften up Iraq prior to the war. They were violating all kinds of airspace, going in there and destroying and hitting anti-aircraft sites and radar sites and other things. It had nothing to do with aircraft flying in the no-fly zone. So that was a bogus reason on its face. In fact, if you wanted to make a good case of U.S. aggression in Iraq, you would use the justification of how they misused the no-fly zone principle in order to attack aggressively and antagonistically Iraq. And secondly, on the assassination attempt of the president, there is virtually no credible evidence other than the one leak from a source that no one is willing to back up that there was any such assassination attempt. It's laughed upon in the CIA, and yet she felt so compelled to sit there and defend her president in the most abject manner that she pulled on these two of the most flimsiest justifications for going into Iraq. Of course, the others are so well-worn, I suppose, that she couldn't dare get caught rehashing the same old worn-out excuses the White House has been using.
Well, you know, it was really interesting. About a week ago we talked, and you were critical of Richard Clark and his book, and I was a little upset about that because I'd seen the interview with Richard Clark on 60 Minutes. I was quite impressed by him, but after reading his book, it said that he wants to start writing fiction. You know, his next book will be fiction. I think his first book was fiction. I have never seen so many things in a book that were flagrantly wrong, and of course he goes into great detail about the attempt to assassinate George Herbert Walker Bush. He of course, takes the official CIA line as far as the downing of TW-800 and the official CIA line as far as the Oklahoma City bombing. And I know he knows better about that. And so many of the other things he brought up just aren't true. That book is frank disinformation. There's some truth in it, and some of the things he says are true and fascinating, but I really believe that that book is written to mislead a lot of American people.
What it was really, what his testimony was had done, his testimony was used to create the appearance of tension between the former administration official and who briefly served, Clark briefly served under Condoleezza Rice in the Bush administration. It was made to provide the tension for this red herring, for this controversy, which would divert people away from the fact that they're not really investigating the crucial issues.
Well, what really, when you stop and think about it, here's a man who was in the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, and then Clinton keeps him on. Then after Clinton has kept him on for 8 years, Bush administration keeps him on again. You almost have a feeling maybe there's a force behind of Richard Clark, maybe like some other force that is directing his career.
Yes, I agree.
I will be back in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest is Joel Skousen. So, Joel, continue with the story here.
Well, the important thing to remember... Well, let's switch gears now. I think we've pretty well covered the 9/11 Commission. Let me just state for your readers that if they want to get a copy of last week's brief, they can call an 800 number. It's 877-518-5888, and that's Midas Resources. They carry copies of my briefs to give out as complimentary copies to people. And I have gone through and given an overview of the 12 most important issues that the 9/11 Commission did not cover. If you want to review all of those and the evidence behind them, call that number and ask for a sample copy of the April 2nd World Affairs Brief.
Now, I want to give that telephone number one more time.
That's 1-877, that's toll-free, 877-518-5888. Now, if they want to subscribe to the World Affairs Brief, it's just a nominal subscription fee. It comes out weekly. It's my weekly analysis of the news. They can go to my website, joelskousen.com, and it talks all about... my World Affairs Brief and how you can get it. If you don't have access to the web, you can call my office, area code 801-224-4746, and request samples copies of the print edition. Of course, you can get sample copies of the print edition from that 800 number, but I don't know if they have the information on the cost of those. In any case... if you call that office number, I can during working hours, I can give that information out.
All right, so what's are we going to go next? Are we going
to
go
talk about Iraq now?
Iraq, because I think this is really so important. You know, as I heard the news tonight, they were talking about, you know, 15 Americans dying in the first 9 days of this month. And it really appears that this whole quagmire is beginning to open up now, and that they're going to do everything they can to embarrass the Americans. And even if at great cost of Arab lives, if we're killing the terrorists over there or the killing the opponents, we're going to kill a lot more civilians. We're going to get a lot more anger and animosity towards the United States.
Well, it's really true. You know, when you have Shia and Sunni Muslims who have been long-term traditional enemies joining forces, you know that the hatred of the United States occupation is growing, not diminishing. They've got a real monster on their hand now. Hell has been left out of the handbasket, and they are having to deal with it. Now, as I made this point in the World Affairs Brief, this today's brief that came out, and that is that when you understand the globalist agenda of this administration, you'll see that actual more violence and more hatred against the United States actually plays into the globalist objective. It isn't certainly in the U.S. interest, but your listeners have to understand that the United States really isn't working in U.S. interest. That's simply the game they play verbally with American people. They always project American interest out there, but in fact they aren't. They aren't in there for democracy. And I have a quote by a Middle East scholar who has gone to Baghdad and written extensively in his interviews with people in Fallujah and the other hotbeds of controversy right now, and interviewed why are people during this uprising.
Hold that thought for just a minute. We want to bring our stations back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief, and we started to talk about Fallujah, what's happening in Fallujah, what's happening in Baghdad, the increasing hatred that seems to be being generated by traditional enemies, that is the Sunni and the Shia Muslims, against the United States. And Joel is saying that he has a friend who's been over there to Baghdad and has actually interviewed people. And what does he tell you about how the people really feel? Not what we're being told by the controlled media, but how do the Arabs over there feel? I mean, they're happy to be rid of Saddam Hussein. Do they feel that they can establish a democracy and live happily ever after, as we're being told? Or is there a latent hostility towards America?
There's nothing that angers the Iraqi people in general more than the U.S. claim to be establishing democracy in this country. In fact, the biggest joke among people, whenever something goes wrong in Iraq, their instant response is, oh, this is America's version of democracy. In other words, they always use the mistakes as the example of America, because to them, they know that America isn't there for democracy. Democracy is simply the excuse. They're running a tyranny, they're running an occupation, in order to gain significant control over Iraq, and what version of democracy they are promoting is totally controlled.
Now, what about oil? Do they feel that we're there for oil?
Well, not as much as the American and worldwide left feels that they're there simply to take over Iraqi oil. The Iraqis are more concerned about the appearance that the United States, and they're quite correct, that the United States is going to establish a permanent military presence there. They've always made that very clear, that in terms of not only this interim government that's supposed to take over in June 30th, but also any additional government. There's already language written into this that requires that they accept American bases, which are huge now, in Iraq, as a fait accompli, that no democratically elected government, if there is ever such a thing in Iraq, which I doubt there will be allowed to get rid of American basing. So this is not ever going to be a totally free country back in charge of their government. They're always going to have an occupational force there. Now, as a backup evidence for that, we have to note that the United States is building the biggest embassy in the world in Baghdad as we speak. It's much, much larger than the huge embassy in Moscow. It will be staffed by over 3,000 individuals. The CIA station in Baghdad right now is bigger than the Saigon station was at the height of the Vietnam War, and that was huge. So that means the number of black ops and other deals that the CIA is working and the control aspects is growing by leaps and bounds. The number of mercenaries, these DynCorp, MPRI, Blackwater Security, all of these growing mercenaries are numbering in excess of 30,000 now. Now you think of that, 30,000 of your former Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and others have joined these and been recruited by these security firms, and they're fully armed with automatic weapons, with rockets, with grenades, with all of the high-powered equipment that private people are not supposed to be allowed to have in the United States, that supposedly is the exclusive domain of the military. And yet they're crawling all over Iraq. They're being given access to all of the top-secret information. I mean, they are a seamless extension of the U.S. military, and it's very, very disturbing to the Iraqi people.
And I think really what this is a really a private army of Donald Rumsfeld. I think a lot of these are special forces who've been sheep-dipped, are being well-paid. They can go in and murder and do all sorts of things and mayhem, but we'll always have a plausible denial. Well, that wasn't us. That was them.
Exactly. How's $1,000 a day is typical for some of these highly trained mercenaries. These are hired guns.
They're professional killers. They have
That's
been
right.
trained by the American government to kill. That's, of course, what the Army's all about. You train people how to kill, and that's what they're there for. But they're there for to extend American control over the Middle East, and I think the Iraqis recognize that.
Some of the other myths about the latest rise in insurgency is that, one, that it's based out of the Sunni stronghold of Fallujah, which is all pro-Saddam Hussein people, and that isn't really true at all. From this interview that I published excerpts of in the World Affairs Brief, my contact said that, in fact, a large minority of the people in Fallujah were of a brand of Wahhabism, which is a fundamentalist group that was very much opposed to Saddam Hussein, and they were persecuted ruthlessly by Saddam. So a lot of the people in Fallujah were just as happy to see Saddam go, but it wasn't until the United States started to overreact and shoot a lot of innocent civilians who were demonstrating peacefully in Fallujah that it hardened the opposition, and they decided to take out these four civilians as retaliation.
Well, we're going to have to take another quick break here, but whenever you get into a war, you never know how it's going to end. I mean, once you've opened Pandora's box, once the genie's out of the bottle, you can't put it back in again. And that is why I opposed this war from the very, very beginning, because I knew how it was going to end up down the line. And an awful lot of people, both Arab and American, are going to die needlessly. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Joel Skousen. And Joel, pick up the story from there.
Well, it's also very interesting to look at the situation with Mukhtar al-Sadr. He is the supposed, according to the media, the radical, and he is radically anti-American, it is true. He's a Shiite leader, and the United States has decided to target him directly, and they're waging an outright war against he and his followers. They've surrounded their mosque, and they've been fighting there. They have a large armed militia in the al-Sadr community. But in reality, when you look at what was happening before the United States decided to target him with this phony warrant for his arrest, this warrant, true to form, as the U.S. said, was signed by an Iraqi judge. He happens to be a puppet of the administration. But in any case, that warrant is almost 9 months old. So why is the U.S. suddenly deciding to enforce that warrant upon al-Sadr? Why didn't they do it before? I'll tell you why, and this is a very important thing. Al-Sadr is hit upon a strategy to counter the fact that the United States is clearly going to set up a puppet administration in the name of democracy. In order to counter that, they've decided to take over the civil administration of most of the towns, at least the ones that where the Shia are in the majority. And so this was an underground political agenda which really did threaten to give a political base to the Shia in opposition to the puppet government the United States could not tolerate. And that's why they decided that al-Sadr, had to be taken down.
Now, aren't they planning on trying to put in Shalabi as the dictator or ruler?
That's my analysis.
Right.
Everything points to the fact that Ahmed Chalabi is their anointed one. He's been under CIA pay for many, many years. He's got the typical brand of corruption that
he's a convicted felon in Jordan.
That's right. He built investors out of millions of dollars in his bank that he ran out of Jordan and absconded with funds, and there is some indication that there was some CIA involvement like that in that bank as well as BCC. Chalabi is still under huge contracts with the CIA, which allow him to have millions of dollars to fund his. He's allowed to keep his militia armed, so that he's respected among the Iraqi people, so that at least they don't, counteract him. This is a man to be reckoned with. I believe he's totally unprincipled and will simply, continue to do the bidding. The reason why they want to install Chalabi this June 30th, and that's why that they are determined, despite the rise in insurgency, to continue with the June 30th.
Hold that thought for just one moment. Okay. We'll bring our stations back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief, And we're talking about what's going on in Fallujah and the effort to take down the Iraqi Sheikh. But even more than that, the fact that we already have picked the man who's going to be democratically elected. His name is Shalabi, and of course it's not going to be democracy. He's not going to represent the Iraqi people. He's going to represent the interests of the Central Intelligence Agency, just as Karzai over there in Afghanistan is our hand-picked man, long-time consultant for Unocal Oil Company. So I don't know who Shalabi represents, but we know he's being paid and financed by the CIA and has been for a long time. So with that, pick up the story there, Joe.
Well, I think Shalabi represents the globalist faction of the Anglo-American establishment. He's their boy. I mean, he's been based out of London. He's got all his contacts there. He was treated with kid gloves, given penthouse-type accommodations to live with, courtesy of the British government, as well as his many, many thousands of dollars each month that he received, he and his followers, for bogus intelligence, which, you know, his whole job was to provide the kind of bogus intelligence that the U.S. went and laundered and marketed to the Congress and to the U.N. to justify the invasion of Iraq. I mean, this was collusion right from the very beginning.
And, of course, Shalabi had a vested interest because he knew he was going to be the man who'd run it.
Exactly.
If we went in, if we didn't go in, he wouldn't have his fiefdom. If America, he could give us faulty intelligence, and we went in, then he would be able to take over as had been planned.
Now, one of the big problems the U.S. is facing, though, is that Shalabi and every other person who's viewed as a puppet of the American administration is very unpopular with the majority of Iraqis, even some Sunnis, as well as almost all of the Shia. And so because of that, Shalabi could not get elected in a real democratic election, and that's why they're going to place him in as the leader of the provisional administration, Iraqi administration, so that he'll have 6 months to have the same kind of national acclaim that Hamid Karzai got when he came in his fancy cape appearing before Congress. We're going to see Shalabi paraded before the American people and the press. This is going to impress the Iraqi people that, the U.S. is acting differently now that they have Shalabi, and we can't afford to do without Shalabi because he can control the Americans on our behalf, when in fact just the opposite of true. You know, Shalabi is being controlled by the Americans on behalf of the Americans to keep the Iraqi people in line. Now, clearly, the radical Shiites have a plan to subvert this conspiracy of the Americans to control Iraq in the name of democracy through puppet governments. And that's why the U.S. is attacking al-Sadr right now, and Mukhtar is getting support from Iran. Iran is really seeing an opening here to blow open accentuate the weakness of the U.S. position in Iraq. But going back to my long-term objective, because there is a globalist reason for being in, and that globalist reason, there's a military reason to have all the bases, because Saudi Arabia is not going to be used as a base pretty soon. So that's one major military reason. It's like a huge aircraft carrier in the middle of the Middle East. Then there's that oil reason. I'm convinced that the U.S. has been for over a year now pumping out Iraqi oil on the sly through the new pipeline that they've been secretly constructing between Basra and Kuwait, a separate new pipeline, which I think is pumping oil out on the black market. And not only on the black market, I think that they're probably making hidden secret payments to their coalition partners. You see, the U.S. can't get any of these people to come into Iraq unless they're promising them something other than the table, and one of those things, I think, is cheaper oil through this black market pipeline.
Okay, well, it's really a tragic situation, but my concern, Joel, is the fact we're going to antagonize all of the rest of the Muslims in the world. I mean, we're going to antagonize the people in Pakistan, and we're going to antagonize the people, in the Malaysian countries, and we're going to antagonize the people of Libya and Algeria and Egypt, and this is no way to live. You don't want everyone hating you. And my fear is that this is going to generate tremendous hatred because they look upon us as the crusaders returning to exploit the Islamic people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I stated previously, I think there is a hidden agenda here that does require that you antagonize the rest of the world. And I think it's very important for your listeners to think long and hard about this hypothesis that I have, because we have to, you know, someone would say, why would one knowingly, why would they knowingly antagonize the world? Why would they knowingly bring upon them an inducement for Russia to throw a preemptive nuclear strike at America? And one of the reasons why they wonder that is because they labor under the illusion, which has been fomented by the leftist mentality and the leftist critics of the Bush administration for so long, that all of this is about oil, wealth, and greed, and corporate insider relationships with government. And that's really erroneous. It isn't that it isn't there. I mean, there is corporate greed, a lot of it. There are a lot of insider relationships. We see it with Halliburton and with all of these mercenary companies. But it's not the whole, it's not the major reason for being. This is a collaboration with a satanic plan to undo Christianity, Western civilization, American sovereignty, Israeli sovereignty, and any other nation's sovereignty who resists the global New World Order. This is a very diabolical plan. And it's very necessary to offer inducements to people. This is how you operate a conspiracy correctly, if you don't want it discovered. You don't tell many people about the satanic connection or the ultimate guiding hand. President Bush may not even know what, when he implements the orders that he gets down from Dick Cheney and others who are his handlers. He doesn't know, perhaps. I mean, this is not a high-level player. This is a person who was a nondescript, shabby businessman who, you know, had everything handed to him on a silver platter, and he was bailed out and protected by Harvard University and every other string that his father could pull. This has not been a major player. So I don't think he's running the show. I think he's just way down there in the middle, and he may not know. And that's how you run a conspiracy properly, is you use predictable people. You give them rewards, such as big oil contracts. You allow them to enrich themselves semi-legally so that they can continue to feel good about it. But they unknowingly become very, very dependent upon a couple of things from their ties with government. One is the steady, guaranteed, no-bid contracts, which continue to be issued, by the way, despite the President's promise in the last State of the Union message that everything would be on a bid basis now. But the other is there's a said and unsaid promise of immunity if something goes wrong. I mean, how else did Enron, who is big as an insider corporation with the government, how did they get away with 900 offshore tax shelters and never been audited by the IRS? If you or I did even one of those, we would trigger an audit. And they were never audited. That's because they had immunity. That's because there was a wink and a nod among the auditors, and they said, nope, that's a hands-off corporation. We don't touch Enron. And now we find out, it's a strong suspicion at least, that the real reason why Vice President Cheney has been stonewalling about releasing the records of the secret meetings they had on energy meetings at the White House is because that there were a couple of things. One, you know, there were promises of collusion and price fixing that they were going to do vis-a-vis California and the energy shortages, which were contrived. They specifically took power plants offline to make the energy shortage occur at the time that they did so they could get this high escalation of prices. They're being sued for billions of dollars right now, several corporations, by California because California has got wind of what's going on. But in addition, what one insider has said is that in the meetings they actually discussed, and this was before 9/11, they actually discussed the need to go in to Iraq and attack Iraq and gain control of Iraqi oil and several other countries and Afghan oil. They discussed the pipeline that was necessary to take down the Taliban. So if they were to release those records, you see, it would be proof that there was prior knowledge about these invasions and they were simply using 9/11 as an excuse, a very convenient agent-provoked excuse, in my opinion, to be able to justify these attacks.
Well, I have no question that is absolutely true. I don't know what was in those meetings, but I know, according to Paul O'Neill, at the meetings of the cabinet in January and February of 2001, 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack, on page 96 of Paul O'Neill's book, he talks about the meetings. He goes to these cabinet meetings. They've just taken over the government, and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney are talking about going to war with Iraq. And they don't say why we're going to war. It's just how are we going to go to war? How soon? How are we going to justify a preemptive war with Iraq and various ideas of how we get the American people to go along with that war? And I know you'll be getting a copy of my latest newsletter. I just give exactly what was said. It's so obvious if you read that book, the war with Iraq was planned long before 9/11. 9/11 was the excuse. It wasn't the real reason for going to war with Iraq.
Yes, and that's come out in a variety of sources now. One of Tony Blair's military chiefs was present at a meeting between Tony Blair and the president and has now recounted to The Observer. If you go to their website, the UK Observer, you'll see this story where it's all over Britain now that you know, they kept talking about going back direct. You know, Tony Blair said, look, we got our hands full in Afghanistan here after 9/11. He said, yes, we've got to get that over with as quick as we can and move on to Iraq. And Bush kept pushing this. It was very obvious that he had a fetish that he was going to go to war and have a regime change, whether it was justified by anything at all. And that's why they were fishing for the evidence to be able to make the case. They simply had ulterior motives and wanted to do this. Had to justify it.
You have to be terribly evil to want to precipitate a war, because wars are terrible things, and innocent people and men and women and children and civilians are killed, as well as the soldiers. And when you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end.
Well, you know, I'm not so sure that you don't know how. If you're running a principled war and you have principled objectives, you don't have these kinds of extraneous consequences of war if you're careful. Now, the United States, for example, has a lot of political agendas going on. Let me discuss a couple in terms of the military situation. Many of the reporters are really complaining now about the heavy-handed censorship that's going on. Even embedded reporters are not allowed to take pictures of American dead and wounded. And, of course, this is what has always made battlefield photography what it was in the days of the war, is the casualties and the horrors of war, but that's off limits now. What's even worse, though, is that reporters are not allowed to take down the names of anybody who's been killed, and the evidence is becoming very, very strong that the U.S. is selectively or is deliberately suppressing the actual numbers of wounded and killed. For example, you know, my contact that I quote in my brief has just been to Baghdad and was talking about people in the Fallujah situation, especially with the armed invasion that the U.S. pulled in Fallujah right now. And it's amazing, no reporters are allowed into the battle scenes going in and out, even the embedded reporters. The Iraqis are noticing, though, that there's an awful lot of stretchers and ambulances pulling people out. And when they look at the newspaper the next day about the U.S. figures for dead and wounded, it's usually a third of what they personally observed. Now, that's what they told my contact, that the Iraqis really are convinced that the U.S. Is fudging the numbers. And we know that because they're not allowing any photographers to be in the morgues when these bodies arrived. That means they don't want to count. We happen to know from certain whistleblowers in the medical facilities in Germany that the amount of wounded that have been coming in, you know, number well over 10,000. The U.S. is quoting some 3,000 or 4,000. So we're looking probably at a significant underreporting of dead and wounded in this war. This is a very political war, and right now that's the major thing that the U.S. is worried about in the escalation of violence there, is that the numbers of dead and wounded are going to continue to rise, and their attempts to suppress it are going to get leaked out. There was one reporter that went on, it was on Market, either on Fresh Air, or I hate that name, Fresh Air, that leftist program on National Public Radio, anything but fresh. But in any case, this was a very disturbing piece. She was talking with a journalist embedded, and he was refusing to abide by the censorship requirements, had taken pictures of the dead and wounded, and just decided he's going to continue to disregard unless they kick him out, because he says this is what war is all about, telling the truth, and we're not going to fudge on behalf of the administration.
But they don't want the American people to realize the horror of war. And
they don't want the American people to demand then that the U.S. pull them out. They want to stay in these wars. And that's why I think, and so does my contact in Baghdad. He says, you know, it's very optimistic for the anti-war movement to believe that the U.S. is pulling out. They're showing no signs of pulling out whatsoever. They're just getting more enthused about staying with every increasing crisis. You know, they're manipulating the events. The U.S. is downplaying it. They're calling it a civil war. It's not a civil war at all. When you have the two opposing factions, Shia and Sunni, joining forces, that's hardly a civil war. This is a war of opposition to the occupation.
How do you feel about the Japanese, that they have taken this hostage and they're threatening to kill them if the Japanese don't pull their troops out? In fact, yesterday we were saying they were going to burn them alive if the Japanese didn't pull their troops out.
Well, you know, if they do those kinds of things like burning alive, that's what they're going to have to do to get the Japanese people to be sensitized enough to demand. It's not enough to hold them hostage. Governments who are wedded to the U.S. globalist objective, as Japan is. Japan, you know, we think that Japan rules the United States because of the trade embargo, but it really is not true. The U.S. still has an ironclad chokehold on Japan, and Japan does what the U.S. wants. So I think that the, you know, Japan is not going to capitulate, but I'll tell you, they start showing video of people burned alive. It'll sensitize the Japanese people enough there will cause that, an uprising against their own government. These people are very smart now. They're knowing after, they know after Spain how to really twist the knife on these pro-Bush administrations. They know that Bush is not popular in any country of the world.
Well, what a tragic situation we're in. I want you to give your telephone number and your email just one more time, because we have everybody listening now all across America.
Okay.
How can people get the World Affairs Brief? How can they get your information?
The World Affairs Brief, you can go to my website and read all about the brief. You can even see the archives from the year 2003, last year on back, like a mini history of the world, and see my analysis and how that matches with reality. I encourage people to do that, by the way, because so oftentimes I can't review what I've said in the past when I talk about new issues. Now, they can go to my website, they can call an 800 number and get sample copies of the World Affairs Brief, which is 877-518-5888. Or they can email me at joel@joelskousen.com, and I'll send them the latest issue as a sample.
And that, what about the number of your office? It's 801.
Oh, yes. My office number, if you want to get printed edition samples, is area code 801-224-4746.
That's 801-224-4746. It's an excellent publication. You want to get it. Joel, stay on. We've got three more minutes, and then we'll let you go.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening has been Joel Skousen. This is not a nice thing to talk about. I hate the thought of what's happening over there to the Arab people, to the American boys. The tragedy is it's all manipulated. There really is, and I think Joel will agree with this, there is a satanic conspiracy in the world that is promoting this war as they have promoted other wars in the past. My fear is this is going to lead, and let's get Joel's thought on this. This is going to lead to probably eventually a World War III and a nuclear exchange. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I agree. It's part of my major theory. I would like to encourage people to go to my website, joelskousen.com, and read the big blue banner about halfway down the main page called Strategic Threats. Short for Strategic Threats of the Coming Decade, where I outline this unique theory concerning the three predator nations all competing to try to control world government, the Russians and the Chinese, which are currently aligned. Eventually they'll fight each other and come against the West, which there's an Anglo-American establishment attempting to establish a new world order. All of them will use war to get to that new world order, even though they're progressing in that way slowly. Something about a time frame that they need wars to hurry things up, and hurry them up they really do, just as 9/11 accelerated and forced upon the American people diminutions of their constitutional liberties, which would not have otherwise been possible without this phony war on terrorism. And you know it's phony because when you only have high-profile attacks and you don't have the rash of normal attacks like they have in Israel every week, you know it's not normal terrorism, it's state-controlled terrorism.
And
what I fear is our own government's that state that's controlling this shell movement of terrorists, this phony terrorist organization called Al-Qaeda. And, of course, the reason Clark and all the rest are admitting now in testimony that Al-Qaeda wasn't mentioned in any of the 33 reports that Condoleezza Rice told to the Principals Committee in the Bush administration is that why should we mention something? Al-Qaeda's our organization, you know. It's not something we mention about legitimate terrorists.
Well, if that sounds difficult for our listeners, we have a book written in 1999 by a Swiss journalist called Dollars for Terror, Going into Who Funded Al-Qaeda. And you'll be very surprised. It was not only Pakistan, as Condoleezza Rice suggests, but it was Saudi Arabia, which she specifically avoided mentioning at her testimony. And, of course, it was the CIA, which she would never mention. Joel, thanks very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you here with us on Radio Liberty.
Thank you, Dr. Stan, for having me.
Good night, and God bless. And if you'd like to get that book, Dollars for Terror, it's available by calling 1-800-544. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and the book Dollars for Terror, written in 1999 by a Swiss journalist, one of his close friends who was a Muslim, had been killed by the
Al-Qaeda,
by the radical element, and so he spent 4 years traveling across the Middle East trying to find out who was behind this radical movement and Osama bin Laden. And he came to the conclusion, after talking to many people, hundreds of interviews, that the CIA was deeply involved with Saudi Arabia and with Pakistan. You've heard Condoleezza Rice's testimony talking about the Taliban. And she said they were funded by Pakistan. The Taliban were funded by Pakistan. Well, she didn't mention Saudi Arabia. In fact, everything has been done to prevent the American people from knowing that Saudi Arabia was involved in funding Al-Qaeda. In fact, the president, as you recall, censored 28 pages of the initial report from the Joint Select Intelligence Committee of the House and the Senate. This was about a year ago, and wouldn't allow any mention of Saudi Arabia funding of Al-Qaeda. And the reason they don't want that to come out is because the CIA has been working with Saudi Arabia. And that was the story of the book entitled Dollars for Terror. There's another book by John Coley written in 1999 called Unholy Wars. It will tell you how the United States funded the wicked Taliban. And if you read President Bush's speech on the 20th of September, you can go to the White House webpage and pull that down. What 20th September 2001, 9 days after the 9/11 attack. Why President Bush said it there, he said all that needed to be said. He said America is the largest single source of funding for humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. In other words, food and other medical supplies to Afghanistan. We were the largest supply of food and medical supplies to the Taliban. But you can't let the American people know that, because then we went in and started to kill them. But we did that because we were going after the wicked Osama bin Laden. Only we didn't go after the wicked Osama bin Laden. We let him escape. And that's covered beautifully in my video, 9/11 Contrived. But if you'd like to get more documentation on that, we have an article out of the Washington Times quoting a high official who said, during the Afghan war, our program is not Osama bin Laden first. If we got Osama bin Laden, how would we justify continuing this war? Or the book by Paul Sperry, which we carry, called Crude Politics, written by Paul Sperry, the senior correspondent, Washington, D.C. correspondent for WorldNet Daily, who talked to the Green Berets and Special Forces when they came back from Afghanistan. They said they weren't allowed to go after Osama bin Laden. That's why we couldn't get him. Ladies and gentlemen, if we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why have there been no major terrorist attacks in America September 11th of 2001. Have you ever wondered about that? If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why is it that the administration is doing everything they can to block and discourage our airline pilots from carrying guns on board? You would think they'd want those pilots all armed so that they could protect the crew. You would think we would have marshals on every plane, which we do not have at the present time. You would think we would try to seal our borders to keep the wicked terrorists from getting into our country. You would think that every plane would be actually armed with weapons to deflect surface-to-air missiles. None of these things are going on. There have been other attacks here. And the reason is, yes, there were Al-Qaeda cells in the United States, and they were all intercepted within 2 or 3 days of the attack, and we arrested 1,200 Muslims, supposedly on immigration charges, and many of those are still being held because they're terrorists, and we're not about to release them. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd first like to get my video, Iraq, the Untold Story, give you the real reasons why we're in Iraq, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 and then pray for America. Pray for the boys over there and for the civilians over there, for the families that will be losing loved ones, both Arab and American. And then please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until Monday when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, saying, remember, this is a spiritual battle. There are satanic forces at work. It's the only way to understand what's going on. May the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, managers, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we ask that you hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Lorene Murray, and we're going to be talking about the depleted uranium problem. Now, what is depleted uranium? Well, depleted uranium is uranium oil, or we're about less than 1% of the uranium has been removed, and that is the uranium-235, which is used in nuclear reactors and manufacturing nuclear bombs. But all the rest of this is uranium, predominantly uranium-238, that gives off alpha rays and gamma rays. Well, I'm sure Lorene can give us a better explanation of what the depleted uranium is. Lorene, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Montes, for inviting me to speak on your show.
Now, certainly, is it the alpha rays or the gamma particles? What is it that's harmful about the depleted uranium?
The alpha particle and the gamma ray are both ejected from the nucleus of the uranium atom when it decays. And it's not so harmful when it's in minerals and rocks and outside in the environment, but the most harmful form is when it is inhaled. And when depleted uranium weapons are shot out of guns or out of airplanes or dropped in bombs, it reaches very high temperatures. It's a metal that burns, which is called pyrophoric, and it forms very, very tiny particles that are 1/10 of a micron and smaller. A tenth of a micron is 100 times smaller than a blood cell. So when this is inhaled, it's like a radioactive gas. And it goes straight into the blood, and it just goes all over the body like fairy dust.
And, of course, then you begin to get these alpha particles and gamma particles. And you don't die right away, but apparently as time goes by, you develop all sorts of progressive illnesses. And many of these people, of course, will get a certain percentage, will get leukemias and other bone marrow conditions, because some of this goes to the bone, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Uranium goes into the bones, but these very tiny particles... The particle size is what's so critical here. They're such very, very small particles. They can pass the brain barrier into the brain. They can pass the placental barrier into the developing fetus. It comes back in the sperm of the soldiers, and they contaminate their wives and their partners. It's just a terrible, terrible weapon. It's very effective, it destroys things, and it kills people, which is what weapons are meant to do, and it's the job of the military to use effective weapons. But this is a weapon that acts from the inside out. Conventional weapons act from the outside in, and there is no way to turn this off, and there is no way to clean this up.
And, of course, once you get inhale this, it gets into your system, why, it'll be with you for the next 4 billion years.
That's
and,
right.
And, unfortunately, we all, so many of the weapons over there, even many of the bullets, have made of depleted uranium, the bombs, the missiles that we've used, and we have contaminated all of Iraq. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Loren Murray. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Loren Murray, and he's been trying to sound the alarm about depleted uranium. Now, the military likes depleted uranium. After all, their job is to win wars. And this will, when fired in the form of a missile at a tank, will go right through the tank like a hot knife through butter and explode inside and, of course, burn and destroy everything within that tank. The trouble is that that tank will be contaminated forever. There's no way to clean that up again. And so what do you do with all of these things? Well, you just have to bury them. But as you begin using these bombs and missiles in the civilian areas, you contaminate all that area. And what the dust that is created by the burned uranium is uranium oxide. And that is, of course, what is inhaled. And this is why people, over a period of time, become very ill. Do we have any statistics on what percentage of the people who've been in contact with the depleted uranium will get ill, Loren?
Well, there's not very much information on the people of Iraq, although Japanese journalists and photographers and videographers and others have gone to Iraq, and also Iraqi doctors have come from Basra to report on the long-term effects of the depleted uranium just on the residents of southern Iraq, and it's really terrible. But I do have more information from government sources about the impact on the Gulf War veterans.
Now, this is the first Gulf War.
From 1991.
Okay, fine. Why don't you tell us what you've learned? Because the government keeps saying, there's nothing to worry about. You can trust us. This is not harmful. But they've ordered people who believe it is harmful, military officers, not to say anything under fear of court-martial. In other words, you were not to say what you know to be true, and that is that this is harmful and there's no way to clean it up afterwards.
That's right. And what we do know is that of the approximately 700,000 American veterans who returned from the 1991 Gulf War, about two-thirds of them have been exposed to depleted uranium. One-third of them, 245,000, are on permanent medical disability now. They will never work again. Their bodies are just destroyed. Their health is destroyed. Many of them have contaminated their wives, and in a study on Gulf War veterans done by the Department of Veterans Affairs, they determined that in a group of 251 veterans in Mississippi who had normal babies before they went off to the Gulf War in 1991, of the babies born after the Gulf War, 67% had severe birth defects.
All right. Now, of course, there were many, many causes for this sort of a problem. There were the oil fires, and there was the exposure to sarin gas, and there were the vaccinations, experimental vaccinations that were used on the boys. So we can't really tell how many of that 250,000 were depleted uranium. Is there any way to tell? Because there are probably multiple causes of the Gulf War syndrome.
That's absolutely true. The Gulf War was the most toxic war ever in world history. And when you combine chemicals and radiation, they have a synergistic effect so that it enhances the effect of the damage. It increases the damage by 8 or 10 times. Now, there were also biological agents and the vaccines, and all of that together, it doesn't really matter how much it was depleted uranium. We could never tell that, really. The combination of all of those agents working together has just destroyed these soldiers. And by 1995, 95% of the soldiers serving in Gulf War I had been pushed out of the military. And they just went out to small communities, economic drafting. They got a whole new group of young soldiers and men and women, and they've sent them off to Iraq. Basically, they're just cannon fodder in the eyes of the U.S. government.
Well, that's a horrible thing to say, but we can safely quote Henry Kissinger. I think he expresses the opinion of the elite, and you can find this quotation on page 194 of Woodward and Bernstein's book, The Final Days. That's Woodward and Bernstein, The Final Days. I believe it's page 194. And you'll find the exact quotation in my syllabus, Iraq, The Untold Story, where Kissinger said, "The military men are stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy. Military are stupid, dumb animals to use for foreign policy." That's what the elite really think. That's our president's friend, the man who was one of the advisors to George W. Bush as he was working to become the president, the man that George W. Bush picked to head the 9-1-1 commission. Fortunately, the families wouldn't put up with him. But there is an attitude of an elite that our military are simply expendable.
Yes,
they're an expendable elite, and the tragedy is the elite are not sending their sons over to fight and die. They're sending your sons over to fight and die, and that's what's so unconscionable about this. I love America. I love everything we stand for, but both of our political parties have been taken over people by who have a different agenda. And until the American people realize this, we're going to continue having wars, and people are going to continue dying. And the great tragedy is they may not die in battle. As many of the young men came home and women came home safely from the Gulf War I, they just died after they came home of the contamination. And any of you want details on that, much of this is covered in a government report called the Rockefeller Report. We actually call it that. It came out of the Veterans Administration over the name of J. Rockefeller. It's available through our ministry. And if you want to know how to get the Rockefeller Report, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. You need to get the Rockefeller Committee report or the Rockefeller report to understand the background of the first Gulf War. They don't get so much in depleted uranium. You can go up on the internet, as I did, and look up the Royal Society over in London. They're a pretty conservative group. And I wasn't about to take a position on depleted uranium till I saw that they were very concerned about the danger of this. And at that point, I said, gee, if that's true, why aren't I reading about this in American medical journals? Why aren't I hearing about it from CBS, NBC, and ABC, or Rush Limbaugh, or Bill O'Reilly? And then, of course, it should be very obvious why we're not getting it, is because they don't want the American people to know.
That's right.
Go ahead, Lorraine.
Well, what I said is brutally honest, that our soldiers are cannon fodder. But I want the audience to understand, the listeners to understand, the people who were parents and grandparents, the young people who are listening, that this is going to be an endless war. These wars are going to continue. These wars are staged under the guise of protecting our country. But in fact, they are being staged to benefit a few. The oil companies and those who are connected to the oil companies and that industry. It's a very, very powerful industry. And I have been reading this week that they're planning to reinstate the draft. They want to draft all young men and women between the ages of 18 and 26, and apparently it will begin next spring, 1 year from now, or a year from this June 2005, as soon as the election is over.
Actually, they're talking now about a selective service for people in the medical field and people in the computer field. If you are either one of those, they still have the selective service system in place, and they're really short on people in those two fields, and so we may see those people drafted sooner.
That's right. Also, people with language skills. They're looking for translators and interpreters. So, it's just what's happened to the soldiers of the first Gulf War is really a tragedy. They've had no medical care. There was no testing done on them. And now, just this last week, a major story has been breaking in New York City.
No, but we haven't heard it out here on the West Coast. At least I haven't.
That's right. A group of about 14 soldiers returned sick from Iraq, and they were unable to get any medical care or help from the Pentagon.
Now, were they reservists or National Guard? Because they are not entitled to medical care.
No, these were regular military police.
Okay, the regular Army, because you would think that they would at least take care of them.
Yes, they were Army personnel, and they were police, firemen, and security guards from New York City. So they came back, they were ill, they had terrible headaches and all kinds of health problems. They went to the New York Daily News, finally, which is a tabloid newspaper, and one of the columnists there, Juan Gonzalez, really advocated for them. And he was able to convince the newspaper to pay about $11,000 for urine tests for them to determine whether or not they had depleted uranium in their urine. And at least three of them tested positive.
Three of the what? Three of how many?
Out of about 14. But when I talked to Juan Gonzalez, he said actually more of them are contaminated. He had talked to the scientist in Germany who did the actual test. And I just told him if they were all there together in Samoa, they're all contaminated. And actually, the absence of DU in the urine does not mean they're not contaminated. It just means that the DU that's in the body may not be in the urine.
Now, I know. I think that this, for our listeners, they have to understand that if you have inhaled the depleted uranium, it gets into your blood, it circulates in the blood, goes into the tissues, and then, of course, you can get back in the blood again, and the kidneys fill to the blood. And so what you really want to, what they usually feel is that if there is a significant depleted uranium, it will show up in the urine. So you say three out of the 14 had depleted uranium in their urine?
And not only, and then the Pentagon, of course, always says, oh, that's natural uranium that's in the soil and the food and the drinking water. However, this time they also identified uranium-236, which can only come out of a nuclear reactor or a nuclear bomb. It's a man-made fission product, and it does not occur in nature. So what that meant is those men were definitely contaminated with depleted uranium, which had been contaminated with nuclear reactor waste.
Now, does some of the depleted uranium come from nuclear reactor waste, do you know?
Yes, it does. Well, it shouldn't. depleted uranium should only...
It should be just the ore that has been where they've extracted the 235.
That's right. It should only be U-238, U-235, and U-234. When they find U-236 or other fission products in it, and usually it's just trace amounts, but, you know, it's the dirty tale that they've been dumping reactor waste into these depleted uranium supplies. And all of it is just trash, nuclear trash from the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power program. They have 1 million tons of depleted uranium stored at Department of Energy facilities. What are they going to do with it?
Well, of course, they were doing what was logical. They would reprocess it like everybody else in the world, but our Congress won't let them reprocess it. That's why we have the problem with 1 million pounds or more. But then that's being done, of course, to block development of any sort of nuclear energy. So you create the problem by laws, and then you point to the problem, and you say, oh, we need more laws, or we've got to have to bury it all in Nevada or something like that. And then you've got the controversy going, and nobody ever gets back to the point where what do you do with the waste? Why, you reprocess it and get rid of most of it, but they have no intention of solving the problem. They just want the problem.
And no one in any country, in any government, in any military has the right to throw their radioactive trash all over another country. And it doesn't matter whether it's one bullet, 1 pound, or 1,000 tons, or 4,000 tons, which is what has been used now in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But aren't we actually selling depleted uranium shells to many other countries in the world?
We have sold depleted uranium weapons to 29 countries.
And so if they ever come over here for any reason at all, why, we'll, of course, have the same benefits that the people of Iraq have today. It's an incredible, incredible story. And the fact you're not reading about it in your local newspaper reflects the degree of control that exists over what the American people think.
But...
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon and this evening is Loren Murray. And Loren, go ahead and tell us more, because now the newspapers in New York then put out $11,000. They tested these soldiers, and these soldiers are in New York, or are they over in Germany at the present time?
Oh, they live in New York or New Jersey, the greater New York area. And what happened is those three stories broke on the same day, last Sunday, in the New York Daily News. People can get on the internet and see them. The columnist is Juan Gonzalez. And the very next day, on Monday, boy, Hillary Clinton was in the news demanding that the military test all returning soldiers. She's going to pass a bill. Well, of course, they were supposed to be testing all soldiers for the last 12 or 14 years. They haven't done it. They're not giving them medical care. And then Charles Rangel, who is also a member of the congressional delegation from New York, is going even further in demanding a moratorium on the use of depleted uranium weapons. What is the real tragedy is that no one has to come over and use depleted uranium on us, because the amount of depleted uranium, the radiation from that, is 10 times more since 1991 released into the atmosphere than what was released during atmospheric testing up until 1963. So we know that fallout damaged people all around the world. We have an international global cancer epidemic now. A lot of that is due to global fallout from nuclear testing. And this is just another nuclear war. In fact, this is the first low-level nuclear war. And this tremendous amount of radiation will affect global health of all species, not just humans. It's really a tragedy. And very, very few people really know about this.
All right. Have you looked into the what hormesis is? Have you looked into that concept?
Yes. Yes, I have.
Would you like to explain to our listeners what hormesis is?
Well, in the beginning, or over the last decades since radiation really was developed into weapons and nuclear power and so forth, maybe since the 40s, there have been many theories about the health effects or the biological effects of radiation, and hormesis is one of them.
And what is that theory?
And what that belief is that at very low levels, radiation exposure is actually beneficial to people's health. And so people will go and sit in caves or sit in mineral baths or expose themselves in various ways. Even people in Japan and other countries believe this. But in reality, in fact, evolution on Earth, which has made many different animals and including humans, is actually caused and driven by exposure to natural radiation in the environment. It's called background radiation. And any amount of radiation causes genetic changes and mutations. So what that means is that actually there are no safe levels of radiation.
Hold that thought right there.
Okay.
All right, fine. Well, I guess this evening it's Rain Murray, and we would probably disagree on whether it's low radiation. The statistics out of Japan shows that some of the people who survived Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who did not die of the initial toxicity, lived much longer, and I've talked to many of the scientists who've done these studies, but we won't get into that subject. Let's talk about the things we do agree about. That is, of course, what we've done over in Iraq with the use of depleted uranium really is going to be very, very harmful to the people over there, because you get the radiation you get from alpha and gamma rays is entirely different than the radiation, or in many respects different than the radiation you might get from the nuclear explosion. So let's get open up our lines if people would like to call in. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. My concern is that although these stories broke in New York this last week, I did not read them, and I certainly read about 5 or 6 newspapers every day. So somebody is suppressing this information getting out. And if it was not something that was important, they wouldn't be going and suppressing it. Certainly the nonsensical stories that really have no significance, we hear about all the time. Let's go to Roger calling from Allentown. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Yeah, thanks, folks. Two quick questions. I believe your guest also had the Rumsfeld quote similar to the Kissinger one that I kind of forgot about for about a year. And secondly, would your guest be able to tell us if just strontium is a chemical analog to calcium and thereby absorbed? Is the uranium just kind of swept along in the body, or does it have any chemical analogy which might suggest any remediation of the problem?
There are two effects from any radioactive isotope. One is, just you have rightly described it, as a chemical effect. So strontium-90 is very similar to calcium, and the body will uptake or utilize strontium-90 if there isn't enough calcium, perhaps in the gut, you know, when the food is being digested. But if the gut is flooded with calcium, and people eating, for instance, Hispanic people who eat dried corn boiled in lime water, they have a lot of calcium in their gut, and so the body will prefer the calcium and not select the strontium if there's a big choice. However,
What does that have to do with uranium? Because we're really talking about uranium.
Yeah, well, that's the chemical effect. The radioactive effect is for all radioactive isotopes, you're either being exposed to an alpha, a beta, or a gamma ray. It's all the same. With uranium, because it is a very large atom and it has a cloud of electrons around the nucleus, it is biologically unpredictable, and it has an affinity for phosphorus and calcium and many other elements that are important components in cell processes. So it's actually unpredictable biologically. However, it is harmful.
It's there are two aspects. One is the chemical, and the other is the radiological. Alan, pardon me, Roger. Anything else you wanted to ask?
Yeah, that Rumsfeld quote. Did you have that at hand? And God bless.
I do have a quote from Rumsfeld.
Oh, I had one, but I can't. I'm trying to find it right now. I'll find it before we.
All right. Well, then let's go to Herman calling from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Good evening. Thank you. A wonderful program. You know, when you were mentioning the statistics of the numbers of Gulf War I veterans who are on disability, why aren't we seeing these figures here at home? In other words, I go about my daily work, and I rarely run into anyone that says, I know somebody that's disabled. So I'm not disputing the figures that you're providing, but it's as if we here don't know that this is happening or has happened.
All right. How would you respond to Herman's remark that he doesn't know of anybody from the Gulf War who is disabled from so-called Gulf War syndrome?
I'm sorry to say that the figures I've given are correct. They're actually from the government and the Department of Veterans Affairs. When you go and listen to radio programs where they are interviewing Gulf War veterans, it's really, really heartbreaking.
And we actually have interviews with a number of them, Herman. If you want to get our four tapes out on Gulf War, we'll let you listen to some of their stories. They'll break your heart.
Okay. That's right.
Well, I'll be right back here. Hang on.
Okay.
Be right back.
All right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Lorraine Murray, and calling from the Carmel area is Herman. And Herman was asking, well, why are we hearing about this? Well, Herman, if you went up to the Veterans Hospital, I think you'd see a lot of these fellows going there and being patted on the head and saying, well, you just take your Prozac and everything will be fine. And I've actually talked to a certain number of these men. There's a wonderful movie. It was suggested to me by Senator Riegel, who actually did a Senate hearing on the Gulf War syndrome by, I think, about 1994, and found that, of course, we'd given the chemical and biological weapons to, or at least sold them to Saddam Hussein, lent him a great deal of money. And then he went to the background of this whole Gulf War illness and how many people were ill, and about 40%, according to him, 70% of the wives of Gulf War veterans were ill were themselves ill. I think that was a high figure. Anyway, because he dared to bring the truth out about the Gulf War illness, pressure was brought to bear. He was forced out of the Senate. I did eventually track him down, try to get him to come onto a program. He wouldn't even talk to me. He said, though, go to your local video store and get a copy of a video called The Thanks of a Grateful Nation with Ted Danson. And I did, and it's a devastating story of the Gulf War illness. Every American should see it. But I think it's simply another example of the fact that there's an organized effort to keep us from becoming aware. After all, what's 200,000 people in a nation, 250,000 people in a nation of 250 million people? Anything else, Herman?
No, that's it, and just keep spreading the word.
That's all we can do, and just hope that the people are out there listening. I've talked to Dr. Garth Nicholson, who's treated many of the Gulf War veterans. Certainly, Joyce Riley deals specifically with Gulf War veterans. Maybe there's some Gulf War veterans out there listening to the program this evening, and you'd like to call in and tell us if you're feeling fine or if you know anybody that does have the Gulf War illness. We'd love to hear from you. So give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Were you in the Gulf War and you didn't have any illness? Were you in the Gulf War and you do have a Gulf illness? We'd love to hear from you. Thanks very much, Herman.
Thank you. God bless you both.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And, of course, the difficulty is we're talking about statistics, and until you've actually talked to the people, why it's very hard to believe that this thing could have gone on. But we do have an interesting four-tape set. I made it probably 4 or 5 years ago, my interviews with a number of the Gulf War veterans. There was one woman who I'll talk about that as soon as we get back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Marin Murray, is on the front lines of the battle trying to awaken people up to the dangers of depleted uranium. But I was talking about the four-tape set we put together many years ago on the Gulf War illness. There was this one woman, and she was with a grave detail. In other words, her unit, and I think there were 15 or 16 people in it, and their job was to collect the bodies of the dead, and these would be the Iraqi soldiers and the Iraqi civilians, or Kuwaiti soldiers and Iraqi soldiers and Kuwaiti civilians, and just put them into large graves and just cover them over. They didn't have the time or the facilities to bury them in individual graves, so they were just mass graves. Everybody else in her unit was dead, and she was in a wheelchair on the verge of death. And it's a heartbreaking story, and the fact that you haven't heard this sort of thing simply is a reflection of the degree of control that exists today over what the American people think. If you'd like to give us a call, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. If you'd like to know more about that four-tape set, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. You can always go to Joyce Riley's website, American Gulf War Vets. .com, I believe it is. Anyway, look it up, Joyce Riley's website. Anyway, we've got Ken from, Calabasas? Hi, Ken. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good.
I see. Okay. What, did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I got a question for Loren.
Where is Calabasas?
Calabasas, western Los Angeles County.
Okay, fine.
I happen to have written a column interviewing Dr. Polly Grove and Dr. Cohen on the subject of low-level radiation exposure, and in a low-level area, it was beneficial. I just went back through my notes, and the miracle number he had mentioned was 250 micrograys. Now, I don't want to debate any low-level issues here, but what I do have a question for Dr. Loren here. Do you have any exact numbers of what radiation levels are now being left on the topsoil there in Iraq? Because I heard you on another radio show giving a comparison to the number of Hiroshima bombs.
Yeah, Nagasaki bombs.
Nagasaki bombs,
yeah.
Comparing to how much radiation we've left in the atmosphere over there compared to a Nagasaki bomb.
Right. And that is a comparison. If you counted the number of radioactive atoms in the core of the Nagasaki bomb, even though it was plutonium, it was something like 32 kilograms or something like that, and you counted the equivalent number of atoms in depleted uranium, radioactive atoms, a Japanese professor made this comparison. He calculated it. And he found that 800 tons of depleted uranium was the equivalent number of radioactive atoms to 83,000 Nagasaki bombs. And it's the energy that is released from the nucleus, whether it's plutonium or uranium, which is harmful once it's in your body.
Fortunately, you can, touch this, you can pick it up, you can carry it around, it's not going to hurt you. It's once it's in the uranium oxide state that it's harmful. Was that the Cohen that you interviewed, Dr. Bernard Cohen?
Yes, it was.
I've met him and had him as a guest on my program, and I appreciate your input. Any other thing that you'd like to ask?
Just kind of a comment. Comparing the two, that the Nagasaki blast was a single blast. Period.
But we're not comparing the blast. We're comparing the number of radioactive atoms before the blast.
Yeah, that's what I'm reaching for with my comparison. Was that
right.
The few people that actually got a beneficial exposure from a single blast, that was a one time. as opposed to where we're leaving dust now that's going to be inhaled by anybody who kicks it up in front of their face over in Iraq for many years to come.
It's not just in the dust, it's in the air. These very tiny particles, they're called nanoparticles, become part of atmospheric dust. They're invisible. You can't even see them. You can't taste them. You don't know they're there. The Basra residents who were 100 or 200 miles from the battlefields have very high levels of depleted uranium in their bodies. And a scientist that I work with, Dr. Hari Sharma, told me about a year and a half ago he had measured the depleted uranium levels in 71 residents who died in Basra after the 1991 Gulf War, and they had levels of 150 micrograms of depleted uranium per kilogram of tissue. That is 10 alpha particles going off in an average man's body, that sort of a weight, every second.
Now, of course, did they die of uranium intoxication? Did
they
die from other
sources?
They
died of cancer.
They died of cancer, okay.
And they were young, and they were in the prime years of their lives. They shouldn't have been ill at all.
Now, has there been an increased incidence of cancer in Iraq since the first Gulf War? And what about over in Kuwait? Do we have any idea what the statistics are?
There are tremendous increases, which are increasing even faster because of the additional levels every day and every week and every month in their bodies. So the infant mortality, birth defects, cancer and leukemia in children, cancer in adults are just accelerating faster and faster. And that would be expected because they're living in a radioactive environment. Every day they're inhaling more. And it stays in their bodies because it's insoluble oxides. So it's just distributed all over there in their bodies, throughout their tissues and their organs and their blood and their brains, and it's everywhere.
All right. Ken, do you have anything else you wanted to say?
Yeah, just a last comparison, and again, I'm seeking for some specific numbers here. Since the Nagasaki was over 50 years ago, let's look to something that's more recent that more of your audience would be familiar with, and that's Chernobyl. There's a story going around the internet now of a brave young woman who rode a motorcycle through Chernobyl and took Geiger counter readings on her whole trip. And she has pictures of looking over her shoulder at the scenery, and you see the actual Geiger counter readings. Does Loren have any specific numbers of what kind of an ambient radiation exposure is being left in Iraq now compared to Chernobyl?
Well, I know I've seen military officers talking about it, and also newspaper reports that have been reporting 1,000 to 3,000 times higher than normal background radiation. So it's very radioactive there, and of course, you don't even need to be in a hot area to be exposed because it's in the air and in the wind. And these are very dry climates in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they have tremendous sunstorms and dust storms, and these storms actually go all over Europe. They even go as far as South America. They go to the Himalayas. They go to China, and they go around the world. And you can go on the NASA and the NOAA websites and see satellite photos of these huge sandstorms where a billion tons of sand and dust may be carried from North Africa across the Atlantic and deposited on the east coast of the United States. So wherever we're dumping these large amounts of radiation, it's going to end up mixed globally in the atmosphere, and we're all going to be exposed.
All right. Anything else, Ken?
Okay, so the bottom line is that we're reporting more than four times what Dr. Polygrove mentioned was beneficial. We're now leaving it as an ambient atmosphere over there in Iraq, four times what could possibly be beneficial.
I think it's a lot higher than that.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks very much,
yeah.
Ken.
Okay, thank you.
But keep on top of this, and right now we've got Herman calling again. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Herman, did you have another question?
Yes, I mean, this is such an incredible story. Shouldn't our leaders be concerned that at some point down the road, the rest of the world is going to get so outraged that they will have Americans up for war crimes?
All right, that's a good question. What are your thoughts on that, Lorraine?
The United States has made it impossible to be held accountable for these kinds of war crimes. They have refused to join the World Criminal Court. They have forced countries where we're actually practicing with our illegal munitions to actually change their constitution so that our military is not even responsible under international law for treaties that those countries signed before the U.S. went in. And it's a completely non-sustainable, it's an insane foreign policy and path that we're on. And it's going to destroy humanity if this continues. 29 countries have depleted uranium weapons. They have been afraid to use them. The United States and Israel and England and a few NATO countries in Yugoslavia are the only ones who've used them. If all those countries start using them, we are really, truly doomed.
I know that there's been an increase in the incidence of, I forgot whether it's leukemia or lymphoma, among Allied troops that served in Bosnia. Do you remember that story, Lorena? I think it was English cases, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Portuguese, Italian, German, and British troops.
All right, and so what did they find? Because they were concerned about the increased incidence of leukemia in the people who served there, and then, of course, they came up, sounded like with a cover story, saying, shucks, all sorts of people are getting leukemia. The statistics don't verify anything here. Well, maybe just a little bit, but nothing to worry about. Do you remember the exact specifics of the story?
Yes, I do. That's kind of when I started getting very involved in depleted uranium, because there was just a media storm all over the world, and especially in Europe, over that. And what happened is young soldiers came back from serving, and also UN observers in the former Yugoslavia, and they started dying of leukemia, and the doctors and hospitals were covering up what the real cause was. And what happened was some very irate parents in Portugal and Italy and other countries in Europe went to their elected officials and to their governments, and they made a huge fuss about it. And I guess the bottom line is that when people with brown skin in Iraq are dying, or Afghanistan, no one really cares. But when these blonde, blue-eyed soldiers started dying, it was quite different. It's just going to get all of us. And radiation respects no borders, it respects no religion, and it respects no socioeconomic groups.
Well, of course, it was the intense contamination in Bosnia because of the number of weapons that were used and the bombs and the missiles, and you'd have a much higher level there than you would in most places in the world. Wouldn't that be true?
Well, they only used about 34 tons of depleted uranium during that Bosnia-Herzegovina and Kosovo conflict. However, I have scientific reports. One is in Hungary, and they were monitoring the depleted uranium and the gamma radiation carried in the air to Hungary, throughout Hungary, during bombing in Kosovo. And also Greek scientists, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, were measuring gamma radiation and depleted uranium in the air in Greece. They were fired when they reported it. So this really is a major cover-up. It really is a cover-up. They want to use these weapons.
Well, they're very effective weapons, but then there is also another agenda out there, and I hate to say that, but there really are people who have no concern about human life. They have a different worldview. They think that man is a plague on the world, and if we could just get rid of an awful lot of them. And you say, who could ever believe anything like that? Well, I'd like to suggest Jacques Cousteau, who in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991 said, we're going to have to eliminate 350,000 people a day to get the Earth back in balance. And if you doubt that, we have the article out of the UNESCO Courier. And, of course, we have so many other articles about the population control agenda. And if you want to read more about that, go to my website at radioliberty.com. And they're talking about, very casually, about killing off billions of human beings.
You're absolutely correct. It's in fact, I have a mainstream news article from Yahoo last June. I couldn't believe it when I read it. The Pentagon announced that we needed to eliminate 50% of the world's population.
Do you have that article?
I have to find it. It's in all of my files.
Well, when you find it, you be sure to get it to me because I collect all these things. I have a CIA official. In fact, I even talked to him, a retired, who told me that these things had come across his desk at the CIA about a plan to kill off most of the world's population. And he even mentioned that it tied into a man named Maurice Strong, which whose name may not mean much to most people, but certainly, or I guess it was to the Club of Rome, not Maurice Strong. Maurice Strong was a member of the Club of Rome, but it was the Club of Rome that talked about that, and he had given an interview to one of the Boston newspapers about that. And so I did track him down, and yes, he confirmed he was well aware of that. One of these days, maybe I can get him onto one of our radio programs. Well, I think it's so important that when you look at what's going on and you say, this couldn't be true. Well, the reason it could be true is because there are people who have a different worldview than you and I would. And until we can understand that, we cannot fathom the degree of evil that is taking place in the world today.
Well, I'd like to confirm that with other information.
All right, go ahead.
I'm an environmental commissioner in the city of Berkeley, and whenever the Lawrence Berkeley Lab or the University of California at Berkeley has a new project, they have to come to the city government and tell us what they're doing. Now, what we learned is that Rumsfeld is pouring billions and billions of dollars into bioweapons level 4 labs, and these are to design and make and store and whatever they want to do with bioweapons. A bioweapons level 4 lab means that a single bacteria, a single virus is lethal, and they want to put these on college campuses.
Well, I'm not at all surprised that we actually have the, here anybody of our listeners want a copy of the Army Hearings 1969 where Dr. MacArthur testified that if they just appropriate $10 billion, he could, $10 million, he could come up with a new organism that would be resistant to any immunity. And he said some people object to it because it seems to be a new form of killing, but just give us the $10 million so we can go ahead and develop it. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Loren Murray, and we've been talking about depleted uranium and the danger of depleted uranium. And I was just talking about the testimony of Dr. MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee back in 1969. We have that. We'll be glad to send copies of that to any of you who would like to get it. I have the complete text, but we send you just a couple of pages. But Dr. MacArthur, who was in charge of research for the Army, said, you know, there's some people who believe maybe we shouldn't develop this new organism, this one that we can create, that, will, of course, there'll be no immunity to it, because they're afraid it's a new means of mass killing. And Then he didn't say they were concerned about that. He said, yeah, we want our $10 million. And, of course, it was about 6 years later the first cases of AIDS were found in the world. Is that a coincidence? Well, I hope any of you who have questions will go to my website, radioliberty.com, and that's the July-August newsletter of last year. I think you'll find it rather fascinating. It is simply a timeline that takes us up to where we are today. Well, Loren, what are your parting thoughts for our listeners this evening?
Oh, my goodness. I think that I hope that people will find the Gulf War veterans in their communities. And I hope that they will help them, they will reach out to them, they will show them compassion, and do whatever they can. A lot of them are homeless. Their lives have been ruined, and they really went to war believing they were doing the right thing and that they were good patriots, and it just destroyed their lives. So we do owe them something. We owe them compassion and kindness and whatever kind of support we can give them. It's a national tragedy, and we're all responsible.
Men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose.
That's right. And you can do it through your churches. You can do it through your city governments. You can do it through community organizations.
Lauren, I want you to get your website out so people will know how to get in touch with you.
Okay. You can find a lot of things that I've written on the website, www.mindfully.org, or you can just do a Google search on my name, Loren, L-E-U-R-E-N, and my last name is Moret, M-O-R-E-T.
How about traprock.com?
TrapRockPeace.com. TrapRockPeace.org is it com or org?
I don't know.
Yeah, anyway, that's a very, very good resource, too.
All right, God bless you. Thank you so much for being with us, and please keep me posted as to the latest findings. And I think it's so significant that these articles appear in New York, and all shucks, they just never get out here in California or in the Midwest.
That's right, and thank you so much for covering this subject and for thinking of our veterans. Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our program this evening. We do have a four-tape set on the Gulf War Syndrome. We're going to be putting together a four-tape set on depleted uranium because we've done a number of programs with Doug Rocky and Durakovich and other people who are really well acquainted with this. Now, not all Gulf War Syndrome was, in fact, probably the majority of the initial Gulf War Syndrome was not depleted uranium, but some of it was. And I think that our boys coming home, some of them have other diseases, some of them have depleted uranium. But the only way you're going to find out is to study them, and the government refuses to study them. Because the last thing they want is to have another couple of 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 more people they're going to have to pay veterans benefits to. In fact, the whole purpose of the Veterans Administration is not to provide for the benefits to the veterans, but to keep the veterans from getting the benefits. And tragically, we send the boys off to a war with the flags and drum beats and music, but when they come home, we really don't worry too much about them, and I think that's a terrible, terrible tragedy, because we are responsible for what's going on, and we can't ignore that by saying, well, we didn't know, because after listening to this program tonight, you do know, and I hope that you'll want to join us in this really, truly epic struggle to try to get the truth out to the American people. This is what I do 5 hours a day, and if you'd like, you can perhaps even consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. It's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a free copy of our latest newsletter, our March newsletter, which will tell you what they were talking about at the secret cabinet meetings in the White House in January and February of the year 2001, 8 to 9 months before the 9/11 attack. Why, that's in our March newsletter. You'll want to get that, you'll want to read it, and then you want to contemplate it and wonder why you haven't heard about this from the major media. And then, of course, if you'd like to get the four-tape set on the Gulf War illness or on so many other subjects, we carry them on whether it would be the secret government or secret societies or the Vietnam War, the men we left behind, the Kennedy assassination, the TWA 800 bombing, Oklahoma City. We have the information. We need you to get that information out. If you're going to get one item, let me suggest my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And you can get that by itself or with the video and the audio tape, the Brotherhood of Darkness special. And we hope that many of you will go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 5 hours a day, and then you can listen to the archives after you finish with that. You won't get much of anything done, but you'll get an awful lot of information that you can help us disseminate. Look at the various items we have. Pull down our newsletter, copy them, get them out. We're involved in a battle of ideas, but it's really a spiritual battle being fought on a political, cultural, ideological battlefield, because there truly are demonic forces, satanic forces at work in the world today that will claim as many lives as they can, as many souls for eternity in hell. And so our job is to try to make people to understand that there really is a spiritual battle going on. And then, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for our leaders, for our ministers. We ask you to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection, because we're on the front lines of the battle. And lastly, we ask you to pray for, until we with you again on Monday. This is Dr. Stan. Good night, and may the Lord be with you.